You're listening to a Diplomacist podcast. Hello and welcome to the Global Podcast. We're here with the Experts Desk. We're joined, as always, by our three scholars of world affairs, politics, and economics here at McGill University in Montreal. They are Jessica Leiber, Leila Mattei, and Patrick O'Donnell. Let's get right into things with the U.S. election. Now, we've got two major topics in the presidential race that we really want to get to. The first, from the Globe and Mail, hits on something that has literally been making headlines over the past few weeks. That's the avalanche of newspapers that have endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. Two staunchly conservative newspapers in the United States, the Arizona Republic and the San Diego Union-Tribune, both endorsed a Democrat in Hillary Clinton for the first time in their histories. Then, USA Today, which has never formally endorsed a presidential candidate before, urged its readers not to vote for Donald Trump, though it didn't go so far as recommending that they vote for Hillary Clinton. And now comes the Chicago Tribune, which has endorsed Libertarian nominee Gary Johnson over either Clinton or Trump. It endorsed Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, who was from Chicago. With that Tribune endorsement, though, Johnson now ranks second in newspaper endorsements, behind Clinton, but ahead of Donald Trump. But this, of course, begs the question, does it all even really matter? Let's start today with Patrick.
Thank you, Madsen. So I guess what I want to start with this one is that this is really one of these questions where it's difficult to have a subjective opinion. Or it's not difficult, but it's I think less useful than normal, right? A lot of things we can kind of go back and forth, but this is one where really we have to kind of look at the numbers. This article that we have in front of us didn't present too many of them, but I went and did a little more digging. And this is actually something that is quite hotly debated, something that I find very interesting. For the most part, the consensus seems to be, and this is based on several Pew Research Center polls, there was one major study came out of Brown University with a few other co-participants, and it seems for the most part that newspaper endorsements no longer hold the sway that they used to, and in fact they have almost zero.
Certainly in the United States, I would say that that's true.
Right,
I think it's a different media context. For example, if you look at it in the UK, newspaper endorsements definitely hold more weight there than they do here.
Sure, but if we're keeping within kind of the North American context,
right,
I think it holds true with Canada as well. There's a certain skepticism of the mainstream media, as we like to say. However, what was interesting is I'm taking this from a Time and a BBC article, is that it seems that, so, and they can only do estimates, but while 70% of people said that newspaper endorsements had zero effect on their voting, it looks like where we can see is in crossover endorsements, which is, of course, what we're seeing this election. Now, the bump seems to be only 1% to 2%, but, of course, in an election, that could be enough to push them over the edge.
Absolutely, absolutely. Do you have any other?
It's interesting to see how those numbers might play into campaign strategy, because I know specifically calling and get out the vote efforts, at least in this country, only sway anywhere between 1% to 4% of voters anyways. So it would be interesting to see if campaigns try and cater to editorials or newspapers instead of putting, you know, more financing into other aspects of campaigning.
Yeah, I definitely maybe jump back to what Patrick was saying. I definitely think it's interesting how these endorsements no longer really hold the importance that they did before. Because I think you could see before is that these newspaper endorsements, you know, this is something that people who didn't necessarily have the time to educate themselves on each candidate and, you know, politics and political processes, turn to these legitimate and, you know, trustworthy sources that share the same ideologies as them as guidance. And that's not really something that you see anymore. To someone like me, these endorsements do mean a lot, especially for newspapers that have never endorsed a Democratic candidate and now are. That speaks volumes, but sadly for a lot of people, and especially for Trump voters, like diehard Trump fans, this doesn't change anything.
And there is this also, you can touch on kind of this broader distrust that many of those people, and I guess you might say the alt-right, people that support Donald Trump and a lot of his ideals, don't trust the media, but it's not just that. They don't trust a lot of these cultural institutions. You know, you can look at what Michael Gove said during the Brexit campaign. You know, people are tired of hearing from experts. What can we say as members of the media? Are we now lumped in with that group of people that are experts? You know, for the longest time, we were sort of that intermediary between the public and the experts.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this speaks to this kind of, unfortunately, you know, in a lot of ways, the kind of democratization, I guess you could say, of kind of access to information is in a lot of ways incredibly good. On the other hand, I think that the kind of growing sort of fatigue with media or the kind of resentment of media, coupled with how easy conspiracy theories spread now, right? I mean, this Donald Trump birther issue, maybe there were a few major outlets we won't mention who didn't do their part to put it to rest, but this is one of the kind of dangers of this. On the other hand, I think this is where the role of the media comes in, right? The media's role, partially, or the mainstream media at least, is that there is, even with, you know, depending on where you stand, there is a certain level of journalistic standards that is, that is expected. You can't blatantly lie as easily as if you're just some person with a microphone, right?
I want to question for myself whether or not these endorsements and how they are perceived by Donald Trump supporters or the alt-right are possibly pushing more viewers or consumers of media away from newspapers and sources like that because they don't seem to be aligning with either their opinions or their presentation of the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the Arizona Republic in particular has lost thousands of subscribers since they endorsed Hillary Clinton. And they've also, many people on their editorial board have received death threats since they made this this endorsement. So I think that definitely speaks to this, you know, this disconnection between the media, the people that consume the media, and, you know, it fosters this distrust, you know. And I think that even extends broader than just newspapers. I think that can expand to other forms of old media. You know, you look at radio stations, you look at traditional broadcast television stations. A lot of people view them as irrelevant. And I say that as somebody who works for a radio station that is doing their very best, all that we can, to continue to remain relevant in the lives of our listeners.
I will say, I think one of the kind of stories from the last week that really got me sort of back into, I mean, I've never been particularly skeptical of the mass media kind of as a whole, but one of the things that really kind of, I think, is a clear benefit is in the story. As most of you probably know, Donald Trump's tax returns from 85 were released.
From his 1995 tax
returns? 1995, right, showing his $950 million loss. And in that article, they detail their process of verifying those facts, right? They went and found the accountants, they went and found... and, you know, this is something where there really isn't a kind of parallel, equally non-government organization other than mass media organizations.
Absolutely. And let's stick with that now and jump to our second topic, which is exactly that, Donald Trump's 1995 tax returns. The New York Times released a leaked copy of his 1995 state return for the state of New York, but you do also declare how much you will be paying in federal income tax on that form as well. He declared a loss that year of almost $1 billion, which could theoretically have exempted him from paying any federal taxes for the next 18 years. Now, of course, it's worth noting that we don't know that he avoided paying federal taxes because we haven't seen his tax returns since 1995, but there are provisions within the U.S. tax code, there are loopholes that would allow him to do that. Now, if that's true, many Democrats are saying that disqualifies him from the presidency. Is that true? Or is he just a smart businessman for taking semi-legal tax shelters like his surrogates keep saying? Let's start with Jessica.
I don't really like the use of the term semi-legal because although we might see it as a loophole, I personally do not. You have the ability to claim losses against previous and future tax income, taxable income. It works the same here in Canada as well. So in terms of making him a smart businessman or smart business practice in general, that definitely is the case. Many corporations actually buy other companies in lost positions to use that money as a tax shield asset. This is a practice throughout the business world. And I think what Donald Trump has doing, if he has not paid any taxes using this, he's not done anything illegal. And it is far within his rights as a taxpayer to only pay the amount that he is legally obligated to pay. You don't have to claim your tax credits. You could be paying the federal government a lot more than you are. And it's definitely not required of you. So for the Democrats to be saying that this somehow disqualifies him from the presidency, I think is, you know, far beyond the reach of legitimacy. And I am not one to defend Donald Trump. This is the first issue I think I've defended him on.
It sure is.
But I think it speaks broadly for how people interpret paying taxes and how that fits into quite a leftist narrative, if I had to classify it as such.
Yeah, this is one where I'm surprised to find myself actually agreeing. One of the things about this election that has bothered me is I think we've seen back and forth this phrase disqualified. Both sides are going back and forth saying candidate X has done Y and that disqualifies him from the presidency. There are clear things that disqualify someone from the presidency. They're pretty few, and they should be that way, right? Very few things should disqualify you, and certainly not partisan issues like this. I will say, and this is something that it's kind of at conflict with my usual principles, but I think, you know, it's our politicians' job to make sure that the system is one that treats everyone the way they're supposed to be, that is fair, that is equitable. And, you know, maybe this is kind of the game theorist in me coming out again, but I think it's not your responsibility to do more than that system allows you, right? And we see this. I mean, even kind of the wealthiest groups agree with this. We have groups like, last year there was a group of 40 or 50 billionaires or millionaires in like New York that sent a letter to the governor asking them to raise taxes. It's a lot harder to say, I will voluntarily do that, even if your principle kind of guides you to say we should all be paying more.
I'm going to throw to Layla in just 1 second, but first I want to ask. So I think that I largely stand in agreement with what both of you are saying, that, you know, it is absolutely his legal right and imperative to only pay as much as he legally has to. However, having said that, you know, so the reason that he declared this almost $1 billion loss in his 1995 returns is because he made some very questionable... excuse us for 1 second. We're having a minor emergency right now. I'm just going to pause this for a minute. So, sorry about that. We're back now. But the point that I was going to make before we cut out was... So, part of the reason why Donald Trump has declared this $916 billion loss in his 1995 returns is because he made some extremely questionable business decisions in the late 1980s and into the early 1990s recession. You know, he tried to start an airline during a turbulent economic time, which was just, irrespective of your partisan affiliation, a horrible idea. Among other very poor business decisions, notably a string of failures of Atlantic City casinos in the state of New Jersey. So I think that we're all in agreement then that his failure to pay this maximum amount of taxes that he is technically, you know, asked to pay under the IRS tax code, his failure to do that is not, that doesn't disqualify him from the presidency, because there are legal, there are very clear legal guidelines that say you don't have to do that if you've lost this much amount of money. However, is it perhaps his poor business skills that are a greater reason to disqualify him from the presidency?
Absolutely, I'd have to agree. I think that the word disqualified, like Patrick was saying, has been thrown around a lot in this election, and there are a lot of things that Trump could be disqualified, like we could consider him, you know, disqualifiable, if that's even a word, based on a lot of other things, but this is just not one of them because he's completely within his rights. Now, the fact that, to me, it's funny, the fact that he's banking on his strength as a businessman to be elected as president is ironic because of so many of his business failures that are now exempting him from that, you know, those taxes. So yeah, there's a lot of things that I think could disqualify him, but this is just not one of them.
I would say that those business decisions don't seem very viable, especially because it lost the stock prices of many of his companies and he was not able to pay employers and contractors. But if it's very possible, if we look at the present value of his now evaded tax payments and you discount that back, it's possible that he might be actually working out in the end. But again, that's an analysis that would have to be done very in depth.
I will say that, so I actually, just kind of objectively, I do think it's impressive how he's managed to accumulate as much wealth as he has. With that said, I find that impressive in that he has managed to, and incredibly unethical the way he's done it, right? He has not paid contractors, he has, you know, tanked stock prices of companies and ripped off all the investors. His favorite strategy seems to be declaring bankruptcy, keeping the amount he's allowed to keep, and then moving on and do it again. And I think that's what Americans should be looking at, right? Is not, well, okay, but he's done well at business. Americans should see themselves as the investors in his companies, who unequivocally have been absolutely just had their wealth wiped out. Right? We see in this article again, we're talking about his Atlantic City casinos, where the value of the shares went from $35.50 to 17 cents each. Now he made money off that, and that is impressive. I find that objectively impressive that he managed to still make money off that. But that's not someone I want running my country. Right.
And I think it calls into question his integrity. But at the end of the day, I think it is possible to make a distinguishment between how he will act for the American people as a politician, a political figure, or as president, and as someone who is working for Donald Trump and trying to make money for himself, his business, and his family. So I think there could be a distinction there, but that is eventually what people will decide at the polls.
Yeah, and I think that maybe just to like cap off this whole discussion, this whole dialogue about him being disqualified, like shouldn't, like the fact that he should be disqualified over this, when it's really not a legitimate reason to see him like in that light to ask him to be disqualified, but there being other legitimate reasons present, is something that we see a lot with other politicians and other candidates. Like Hillary Clinton is getting a lot of backlash for that email thing, and that's just not a valid reason to be criticizing her at this point. What she wears, that kind of stuff, not a valid reason. There are valid reasons to not want her as president. Same thing for Donald Trump, but this is just not one of them.
And with that, let's move on, staying within the realm of the New York Times. So this time we're going to be going to an article in the International New York Times, heading now to South America. We have the historic rejection of the FARC peace deal by Colombian voters. That happened just several days ago. What ultimately drove this shocking electoral surprise? Remember, this referendum was called with the hopes that it would be an easy win and that we would sail right on into peace. What ultimately drove this electoral surprise, and where does the Colombian government possibly go from here? Let's start with Layla.
Okay, well, first of all, where the Colombian government can go from here is try their very best to revive this deal, because I think a lot of other countries want this deal to pass. But in terms of why it was rejected, well, first of all, let's talk about the turnout, which was only about 37%, and I think it needs 13% for it to hold in referendums in Colombia. So this is like...
That's a very low floor for referendums.
It is a very low, very, very low turnout. And also, the no side only won by less than 0.5%.
Yeah.
So it's very marginal win, sorry. So if the 63% of the rest of the country had turned out for the vote, which obviously is impossible, but at least if another 30 or 40% had turned out, this would have, maybe there would have been a huge difference in the outcome. Now, this begs the question, why was the turnout so low? So some publications are talking about the torrential rains that could have kept people indoors. I think it has something more to do with the fact that this decision was really confusing for a lot of people. You know, you're trying to decide whether peace, immediate peace, is more important, or whether, upholding the standards of the law and standing up for yourself is more important. And that's on both ends of those, this balance, it is just, there's a lot of implications, that come with choosing either of those sides. Mm-hmm. And so I think that because of the responsibility that comes with making such a decision, and the fact that it's so difficult wanting peace, but also wanting to stand up for your country, and it's understandable that the people, after so many deaths, kidnapping, so much harm, like so many people displaced from their homes, like it's definitely understandable that these people would want some sort of repercussions. But at the same time, there's another demographic of people that just wants immediate peace, that just wants this over with. So there's a lot of responsibility that comes with this decision, and I feel like maybe it was easier for some people to just abstain instead of making such a hard, such a tough call.
There were two, from what I was reading of this, there were two separate former presidents of Colombia, definitely on the right of the spectrum, who claimed that were this peace deal to go through and the FARC allowed to participate in legitimate Colombian life, the country would end up with a left-wing dictatorship. Now, obviously, that was nonsense, but it was nonsense much in the same way that many people during the EU referendum in the United Kingdom said that Turkey would immediately become a member of the EU if the UK voted to stay. Now, with that in mind, do we think that this may end up being that sort of, major mistake that the Colombian electorate made, much along the lines of what many people are going to say, Brexit ended up being a mistake for the United Kingdom?
I personally, I was shocked, to be honest. I had almost put it out of mind. I think many of us rejoiced at the news that the peace accord had been signed, and I don't think people really thought about the referendum, actually. At least I hadn't. I just assumed it would pass based on what I was reading. I do think Colombian voters have made a mistake, and I think it's also sad that we've had such a low turnout. But also, I empathize with those who weren't able to kind of go out to the polls and stomach that, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is something where many of these people have had, horrors we can't even imagine inflicted upon themselves, upon their families, their loved ones. And as we see, actually, right, this is where that kind of, post-conflict or in the middle of conflict kind of attitudes start to differ, right? The places that voted resoundingly no or against the deal, were places where there formerly was conflict and it had now kind of moved out, partially because of this U.S.-backed offensive. What we're also seeing is that the places that most resoundingly voted yes were the ones currently in conflict, right? And I think it's easy, but not conscionable, I think, in the end, to inflict this conflict on more people, despite your own sufferings.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I couldn't imagine how difficult it is for people to place, you know, the values of the past, the values of their family, and all the autocracies that were committed against them, as opposed to what could be if this peace deal went through. I think this would very much help, you know, foreign investment in the country, would help to rebuild the Colombian economy, and ultimately be better for all involved. So it's a real shame that did not pass, and I think the government right now is just in a place of trying to appease the no side as much as possible, possibly inflicting more harsh punishment upon those in FARC. But at the end of the day, a good negotiation makes no one happy, and I think this really, you know, defines that point, that both the yes and the no sides have not reached something that is beneficial for both of them. So I think it'll be difficult moving forward.
Yeah.
Let's just let's stop there for a moment. But I want to spend the last couple of minutes that we have on the panel. A couple of evenings ago, at the Monk debates in Toronto, we had four people coming in to talk about the U.S. election. They were Jennifer Granholm, former governor of Michigan, Robert Reich, Newt Gingrich, former U.S. House Speaker, and Laura Ingraham, talking about this question: can Donald Trump make America great again? We're going to have a quick listen to what they all have to say. These are all, of course, esteemed political minds in the United States, and then I think maybe we should talk a little bit about some of the stuff that they're saying.
I would argue that he's not glib, he's not a Yale-trained lawyer, he hasn't spent 46 years in public life like Secretary Clinton, but as a crude, rough-and-tumble businessman who had a habit of actually building things and making them work and having projects, I think he has the entrepreneurial drive, I think he has the courage, and I think he has the force of originality that will enable us to start to break through and to literally make America great again.
This is a man who denies climate change is caused by humans, who vows to cancel the Paris Agreement, who calls Vladimir Putin a stronger leader than President Obama, who says that President Obama invented ISIS, who for years has claimed that President Obama was not even born in the United States. And I could go on and on and on. You get the point. This is demagoguery. This is wielding anxiety and frustration and pointing it at them. This is hate-mongering. This is undermining the social fabric of the United States. So it's not just that Donald Trump is a problem. The problem is that Donald Trump has already poisoned the well.
We need a government that represents all the people, from no matter where they come from, no matter what color of their skin. And Donald Trump promises to do that. And I think a system that is... I still think Canadians are nice. We need to break the oligarchy in Washington, D.C. that has dominated the country, restore democracy in which the voice of all the people is respected.
He would be a danger as president, not just because he's erratic. Don't take my word for it. Take the word of The Economist, their global intelligence unit. Their unit rates all of the global risks. They have determined this month that Donald Trump is the fourth highest global risk among all global risks. In fact, they have never put a politician on this list before.
We talk about Russian influence. It is Bill Clinton who got $1 million from Moscow for a speech. It is the Clintons who gave 20% of American uranium to the Russians at about the time that the firm they were dealing with put money into the Clinton Foundation. It's this kind of corruption which has led a very large number of Americans to say, yeah, Donald Trump may be a risk, but he's a better risk than Hillary Clinton.
All right. And on that note, let's just kind of talk about some of those topics that they're talking about right there. The first one that I want to really kind of jump off with is where Jennifer Granholm, she didn't really say it particularly eloquently, but this was a big deal when it came out that the Economist Intelligence Unit, for the very first time, put an individual person on their list of global risks. So they've never done that before. They usually just put big ideas like, you know, a political revolution in China, Brexit. You know, those are the kinds of things that they normally talk about. But Donald Trump becoming president was number four this year on their list of global risks.
Yeah, I mean, I will say part of that is what we're seeing is that Trump is not just a candidate, right? He's the embodiment of an idea that until now, despite the kind of extreme, I think, tendencies, more recently extreme tendencies of the American right, Trump really represents the first potential high-level kind of elected representative of this alt-right movement, right? In which case, I think you could kind of argue for why he is the first person to be on this list, right? He really is almost more than a person in this sense, as much as I hate to give him, I guess, credit, negative though it may be.
Yeah, I just can't get behind anyone who would possibly say that he'd make America great again. I just, someone so erratic, so childish, someone who can be baited by bullying and bullies back, how is someone like that, and someone who's so poorly educated in politics and foreign relations, how is a person like that supposed to negotiate trade deals when he's never done so in his entire life? How is someone like that, someone who's failed also in the business world, something that he's so highly acclaimed for, he's even failed there in his area of expertise? I can't get behind it. I'm sorry.
There's one point you mentioned there that I wanted to touch on, and why I think maybe one of the main reasons he was put on this list there is it's not because he just doesn't understand the issues, it's that he doesn't want to understand the issues. He wants to take his movement and the ideas of his supporters and himself onto the global stage without any compromise. And I think that could be the possible danger.
Mm-hmm. And his complete refusal also to acknowledge very real problems, like global warming, is that someone that we really want leading our... This is a real scientific, concrete problem.
Now, granted, the refusal to acknowledge that global warming has happened, just to give him credit, where it may not be due, but just to... Because it is 2016, but 16 years ago, when George Bush was elected, he didn't believe in global warming. In fact, I don't think that any Republican president or presidential candidate... Not that that's a particularly high bar, because this is the U.S. Republican Party we're talking about, but still, I don't think that there has ever been a candidate for... Patrick,
but
looks
have
like
we not
would...
made progress
no,
since
of course,
16
of course,
years ago?
Of course.
Have we not?
I was actually... As much as I enjoyed that dig at the Republicans, I was actually going to say something similar. There are a lot of things to criticize about Trump, and in almost every way, he is worse than basically anyone, and hard to compare, in fact, to anyone else. However... many of the things he is criticized for, people seem to forget are not unique to him, right? Climate change denial. For example, this whole Clinton uranium issue, right? This is, you know, has been trumpeted by Trump's camp, but I guess anecdotally only, but in my experience, it feels as though it's been pushed even harder by people like Cruz, by kind of mainstream Republicans. And the reality of it is, maybe she got the donation. I mean, she did. And you can argue about whether or not that was kind of... you know, wrong or right? But there were eight other agencies, I believe eight, perhaps
yes.
Nine other agencies that had to approve, right? And so these are kind of, you know, Trump is wrong in a lot of things he does. And as much as I kind of very much, I feel with those Canadians we heard laughing at the suggestion that Trump is pro-equality anyway, I question, you know, in a lot of ways if he's any worse than Pence or Cruz or...
I think that that's definitely a very fair point, but if the fact is that Trump is our Republican like candidate right now, so in talking about him, if it had been Cruz in this position, who's also adamantly refusing the existence of global warming, I would also be saying that someone who is refuting scientific evidence and is willing to put that at risk and the environment at risk is also not fit to be president. So I would possibly be saying the same thing. For other reasons, I would maybe say that. Like, possibly, I don't want to, like, make any, like, don't quote me on this, but I would maybe say that Cruz isn't as bad, but, like, the fact is that he's who we're talking about right now, and although all Republicans, for as long as we can remember, all have been denying global warming, it stands true for all of them. Anyone who refuses something so obvious, are they really fit to be president?
Well,
are they really going to make anything great
again?
But I
guess so that's just kind of the quick final point, right? Or at least... for myself, is Trump is on this list as the danger to the world, not the Republican Party. So I think it's our responsibility as his critics to also help separate out how much of this is unique to Trump and the alt-right, and how much is shared values, because I don't think it's fair to keep calling these Trumpian values or alt-right values when they're shared by the right.
Absolutely. Fair, fair.
All right. Well, there we go. That was perfect timing. It was great having all of you on again for the Experts Desk. Jessica Leiber, Layla Mattei, and Patrick O'Donnell. Thank you all so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you.